And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. We're going to be joined for the next half hour by Las Cruces Bulletin editor, Susan Morey. Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Walt.
I want to remind people once again, if you would like to join the conversation, give us a call, 575-526-5825. So a lot to talk about since the last time you were here last month. One of the biggest things locally is obviously we know now who is going to be running in our municipal elections and that there will be two members of the city council who are not running for re-election. So can you talk a little bit about what you're going to be doing at the Bulletin as we get closer to the election to help your readers make better, more informed decisions?
Sure. We're going to be sending out questionnaires to all of the folks who are running for council, as well as to the folks who are running for school board.
Oh, great.
And we'll be asking everybody the same set of questions and asking them to fill that out. And then we'll run, just do very light edit, but run basically whatever they tell us.
And do people usually respond, candidates? Are they good about responding?
I think so. I hope so. I mean, this will be my first time to do this, so so we'll see how it goes. But but we have heard already from a number of candidates who've sent in press releases letting us know that they're running.
Good,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, I'd say in the past when Algernon did that same thing that probably 70%.
Yeah.
I mean,
I remember reading through them in the past, and maybe there'd be one or two little blanks. And we didn't get it back in time, kind of.
Right, but. And I never understood this, but there are some people who run for office who just have a hostility towards the media and just won't do interviews, won't do questionnaires, won't do town halls.
But me as a voter, I'm not terribly interested in people that won't even contact with the public. They end up shooting themselves in the foot.
I was just complaining that I hate uncontested elections, so I'd rather have somebody on the ballot. But why are you doing that if you won't answer any questions? But anyway.
Right. And we're not writing stories. We're letting them fill out the questionnaire.
Yeah.
So
they have control.
They have control. We're not filtering.
Are you going to limit the answers to how many words or just... Because I know from, when we did that, some people give you like two-sentence answers and some people go on and on. And my thinking was, that's their choice. And then it becomes the reader's choice whether they want to plow through all that or not. But that was just my thinking. I mean, how are you guys planning to do that?
We might have to have some limits just because we have so much space in print. And we are very tethered to our print products still.
Yeah.
So but we have a pretty good amount of space, we can give them quite a bit.
So how do you come up with questions that you're going to ask?
Well, I'll be sitting down with my reporter Noah Rice and and we'll go over questions and brainstorm and really work hard to come up with questions that we think are important to the public and to the community of Las Cruces. So.
Okay.
And, I know it's still early, but looking at the city council first, what do you think the big issues that voters are going to be, wanting to learn more about? Obviously, it seems like public safety is probably at the top of that
list.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say, is crime.
Yeah.
And drugs, crime,
yes.
Guns, all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I agree with that. And probably housing would be.
Right.
Yeah,
affordable housing.
Yeah.
And the unhoused population.
Yeah, yep. I think all of those are right. How about for the school? I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that much. The only thing that I'm aware of that gets a lot of attention is, the books in the library and, people who think that take offense to that.
Yeah,
right. And, there's also been a curriculum change this year. So we'll probably ask some questions around that. I'm wondering if people have really adjusted to the school calendar. There's always seems to be some frustration around the fact that kids in Las Cruces start school so early in the summer. And I don't know how much control the district has over those, but And then, of course, there's always budget questions.
Right, right. I was surprised that they put out a survey that said that most of the parents supported the early. You know, it was their survey, so you know, take it for what it's worth. But that surprised me because you maybe just the people who don't like it are the louder, you know, you're more likely to grumble about what you don't like than you know, praise what you do. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just ready to have their children out of the house by school. But, I'm also curious because I know the League of Women Voters recently has been, you know, issuing a strongly worded support for multilingual, bilingual, multicultural and civics education in the public schools. Is that a brewing issue? Are you seeing any pushback to the schools being involved in the multicultural, multilingual civics education thing? I was wondering what had prompted the League of Women Voters to write this piece in the Bulletin just fairly recently. In fact, to see Patty Wojohn, a friend of mine, was one of the authors.
Well, I can't speak for the League of Women Voters. I don't know what prompted that. But the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit came up again recently. And I think I'm not hugely adept on this issue. I haven't written about it, but I believe that the plaintiffs went back to the court because they said that the state was still not meeting the criteria of Yazzie Martinez's lawsuit, and you know, that's an ongoing issue here, I would imagine, because there's plenty of students here who are multilingual.
Yes,
and for people who aren't, Yazzie Martinez was this big groundbreaking case in the state Supreme Court that requires, I forget the exact language, but equal or equitable education for everybody, meaning you know, primarily Native American students, Spanish-speaking students, and students from low-income households, primarily. And I don't. If you were to ask the people who filed that lawsuit, they would tell you that the state has never fully complied with what the courts have required them to do, and you know, maybe never will. I don't know. I mean, it seems like they set a fairly high standard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of another question for potential school board members would be about the state of the buildings that the schools are in, and you know, facility questions, because that was also part of the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit as well.
I think they have. The elementary school that was forced to move out and rebuild because of the mold situation.
Yeah.
Have they moved back in?
They
yet?
Did. We wrote about that. Yeah, okay. They moved. Yeah, they are the back case. To school for the first time since 2018 in the building.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the high school now has to redo the bathrooms where the elementary school kids were.
I was going to say, for so long they were basically sharing a campus with high school kids.
Yes.
Which
yeah.
is a little odd.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you. We're in the about the visit by Senator Lujan.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play the interview he had with Peter Goodman here later on in today's show. But you also have a story in the Bulletin about his visit to Memorial Medical Center and his concerns about what is coming down the pike in terms of Medicaid cuts through this. Big new bill or whatever bill. Can you tell us a little about his discussion, you know, with the healthcare officials there at MMC?
Yeah, it was very bleak, I have to say.
Yeah.
All of the hospital administrators who were there, and that included Sierra Vista Hospital in Tier C, the Membrace Hospital in Deming, a couple of different, or maybe all three members of the hospital administration from all three hospitals in Las Cruces were all there, as well as folks who were just advocates and then some folks who represented smaller health clinics. And they all gave very, very bleak pictures of what's coming with the Medicaid cuts, and also it's going to affect some Medicare. And despite all the claims that Medicare wouldn't be touched.
Yep.
So, you know, I've read that as much as $1 trillion could come out of the healthcare system overall with these cuts.
Wow.
And 17 million could lose coverage in total. That's national, not within the state. But
that's devastating.
It is devastating. Yeah. And then when you add on top of it all the problems that New Mexico already has with its health care, with the
the aging doctors and the aging doctors,
you know, but the medical malpractice,
insurance
issues, and providers leaving the state just because of that, and rural hospitals, you know, already on the brink in a lot of
situations.
Yeah,
this will just devastate rural hospitals.
And
that will affect Medicaid patients who use those rural hospitals. So that's one of the ways Medicare, is impacted as well.
Exactly, yeah. And the head of the hospital in TRC said that his hospital would have gone out of business if it hadn't been for the state funding that helped stop that hemorrhaging year or two ago, and now, you know, these kind of cuts are just going to be devastating, and then that impacts places like Memorial and Mountain View and Three Crosses, because then you have more rural patients desperate and coming to the urban hospitals because they can't get the care they need at the rural places.
What was the message from Senator Lujan? Did he have any glimmers of hope for them at all, or what did he say in response?
It was mostly a listening session on his part, and you know, he talked about his own personal situation, having suffered a stroke 3 years ago, and how life-saving it was that he was able to get medical care right away, but beyond that, you know, he didn't offer anything policy-wise.
Right. I know, or at least I get the sense that for the time being, the state hopes to be able to step in and appears to be in position financially for a little while to be able to step in. And but I guess long term even short term, it's going to be difficult short term. And then long term, if policy doesn't change, it just seems like it's not going to be sustainable. And we're not the only ones who are in that situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think we're in a particularly difficult situation when almost half of the population is on Medicaid. And then I think another 20 or 30% are on Medicare.
Yes.
You're talking about the majority of the population on one or the other. And, you know, close to 80% of births are covered under Medicaid in New Mexico. So, you know, we're in a pretty difficult situation as a state, although we do have a lot of money right now.
Yeah, right now we do.
But, you know, a lot of that's dependent on oil and gas prices. And
yes.
And then I don't know if, you know, if there's a will in the state legislature to change any of those permanent fund, which would be the other, potential place where they could draw some money from.
Well, when you said will, I thought you were going to go to the medical malpractice, because that's to me, that's so frustrating for people, you know, who don't go to Santa Fe and aren't familiar with how the legislature works. For a bill to get passed, every bill that deals with money has to go through both the House and Senate Finance Committee as the last committee before it goes to the floor. Any bill that deals with law, including medical malpractice law, has to go through the Senate and House Judiciary Committees, which are both filled with lawyers. I don't think there's a doctor on either of those committees. And so I'm sorry, but it's you get a citizen legislature. If this is what you want, this is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
We're not paying these people to be up there, so they go up there and they represent their own interests. And if you're a lawyer, you're not going to vote for a new law that makes it be, you know, that infringes on your ability to, or the ability of your peers or your partners, to get enormous, astronomical medical malpractice settlements. And as long as that's the case, it's just very frustrating.
Yeah.
As somebody who's seen the process, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, they may have to blast it out of committee. I don't know. I know they hate doing that. And what that means is they only do it like once every few years. Is if you get enough people who get frustrated, it used to be with John Arthur Smith in the Finance Committee, who would just, you know, bottle things up without ever putting them to a vote. And eventually people say, okay, we're just going to bring it to the floor. But like I said, every few years, they don't do that very often. I don't know.
It would definitely be, I mean, There's one former hospital administrator who tried to bring a reform bill to medical malpractice this last session, and the bill didn't go anywhere.
Right.
Because,
right.
as you said, there's an awful lot of trial lawyers in the legislature. And there are many committees there.
That is a fact. You had a story that I want to ask you about because it surprised me. And that was your story about the economic impact of the spaceport. All we ever hear about the spaceport is that it's failing. The big plan was to send millionaires up into space, and they had all these people who lined up to buy tickets, and they were famous people that everybody's heard of. It was this big, glitzy, glamorous thing. And then they had the crash where the test pilot died and it never got off the ground. And it just looking from afar, it just seems like this abysmal failure. And yet they're putting out a report that they're doing pretty good.
Yeah, the Arrowhead Center at New Mexico State University authored a report, an economic impact study that found that that there has been growth at the spaceport, and in 2024, the economic output equaled $239.8 million, and that's up from $72.3 million in 2019. Their best year was actually in 2023. Virgin Galactic, I think, was starting to send people up in space.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so that has been really the main driver of their positive growth. But in 2023, they decided to stop doing that because they wanted to build bigger spaceships. And so they are doing that right now in Mesa, Arizona. But they're expected to come back in 2026 and start sending more people up in space as tourists in these bigger spaceships. And so that's expected to increase growth again. And then, but the other thing that they're also seem to be really excited about, I talked to the executive director of Spaceport America, Scott McLaughlin, and the other thing that he seems to be really excited about is orbital launches. Currently, a rocket cannot launch from Spaceport America into orbit, into space, because of the potential. It's rare, but if a rocket malfunctions and can't make it, it mm-hmm. has to crash into mm-hmm. the ocean. And they have a whole, you know, what they call a debris field planned out ahead of time if that should occur. But Scott told me that they expect that in about 5 to 10 years, rocket technology will have evolved enough that if a rocket goes up in space and it can't continue and has to come back to Earth, it won't crash. They'll be able to land it.
Right, right.
And once that happens, then they can start sending rockets into orbit from Spaceport America. And so they think that's going to really change things up there.
Well, I think they just did that with the rocket that went up with the four women in it, Gail King, and I think they landed that in the desert. They brought that down onto solid land instead of a splashdown, if I remember right.
But did it go into orbit or did it?
Oh, no, it did not.
Yeah.
That's
the key. So, currently everything that goes up that's not on the coast is suborbital.
Gotcha. Yeah. But yeah, so the technology is there, but just not, I don't know. I don't know enough about it.
Not quite advanced enough to allow for orbital launch.
But no, that's
so. So, Walter, are you interested in going up once it's ready?
No.
We could go up. We could do a show.
No.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm not going.
Yeah. And then Susan can come with us as the reporter.
No, I think
that's fabulous. I want to go to space.
I saw what happened to the Challenger. I'm not going.
I actually know someone who signed up. Do you remember that plan to send some people to Mars?
Oh, yeah.
Oh yes.
I actually know someone who signed up for that.
Is that an Elon Musk deal or was
no,
okay,
I don't think
something
so.
Else.
I think it's something else.
Okay.
And she would leave her husband behind and
yeah.
go off to Mars. And,
yeah.
Did
you talk to her about that? I mean,
just a little bit, and you know, she just is.
Just ready to
go to Mars.
Yeah.
Not me.
No. That sounds not fun at all. another story that I did want to ask you about. I thought was kind of interesting that I'm a little disappointed that we need affordable housing, but every time we put a new housing development closer to the Oregon Mountains, come on, guys, we need infill here. But anyway, that being beside this point, the interesting part of that is the all-electric part, this new housing development affordable. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The state has given some money, and and it's going to enable a development to be built. I don't remember off the top of my head exactly how many homes, but it's quite a number. I think it's over 4,000 homes. And
4,300.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. It's your story. But
I think 1,700 of them will be designated to be affordable housing, and then there's another designation for people who are in a slightly higher income bracket, and then the rest will be market rate. And so it's a little bit of a win-win for everybody. But the other thing about it is that the houses will be all electric as a way to help the city maintain its climate action plan goals.
Right, exactly. I know Noah reported on it, but you are certainly aware of the controversy that is taking place about the county's plans to build this new data processing plant and give an industrial revenue bond to help in the construction of that. Based on what you know about it, what do you think?
Well, it looks like it will use an enormous amount of water.
Yeah.
And I believe the talk is that the water would come from the aquifers. And, there's multiple issues there. First of all, there's Krua, and it's difficulties in meeting water standards. And then they're going to draw, there's already water issues in Sunland Park and Santa Teresa, and then they're going to draw enormous amounts of water for this data center. It just seems like a really, poorly thought plan. And perhaps chosen because of its political win and economic win. But, where is it going to leave us? Yeah. Where is it going to leave the residents in terms of having enough water?
I thought I remembered somewhere that they were planning a brackish water as part of this, or I don't know if I got that right or not. I don't know enough about it, but
I'm not sure we could generate enough brackish water. Are they thinking from agriculture?
I think they're thinking from drilling.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just remember we had Norm Gom on. I mean, the governor is real big into that. The idea we're going to desal it.
Desalinization?
Maybe it's desalinization. I don't know enough. I shouldn't be talking here because I'm not sure what I'm talking about, so I probably shouldn't be saying anything. What haven't we asked you about that?
NMSU announced that it was going to make some it's going to have to make some cuts. They're not in a crisis, but Dr. Fermi announced over the summer that they've been hit in two different ways. One is that they have a $2.5 million structural budget deficit, which means an ongoing shortfall in estimated permanent revenue. But also they've been impacted by President Trump's reduction or complete getting rid of research funds to universities.
And that's huge for New Mexico State.
It is. They've lost $29 million just from that.
Wow.
And so in response, Dr. Fermi announced that every department, including his own, would have to see a 1% reduction in the department. And so what he said he was doing with his department is they had two vacant positions that they were going to try to fill, and instead they're just going to eliminate those two positions.
Yeah, yeah. We had Dave Dubois on last week, the state climatologist, and he was talking about all of the research positions that they've lost, and I think a lot of those are tied to NMSU.
Yeah.
And the scary thing there is, it's scary on so many levels, but obviously, you're shutting down projects that are, maybe halfway done, maybe three-fourths of the way done, and you're just shutting down and you get nothing out of it now.
Yep.
And those people need to work.
They do. And, I mean, also, you know, we just talked about the spaceport. And, you know, one of the things that from that spaceport study that that Scott McLaughlin emphasized was, you know, they've had an increase in jobs and at the spaceport, right? And that directly impacts Doniana County because all the engineers live here in Las Cruces and they commute back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that doesn't just impact the folks who get those jobs, that there's ripple effects.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Because for every professional job like that, there's more jobs that get created that mm-hmm. you kind of don't see exactly, but it's this kind of ripple effect of, because those folks need services, they mm-hmm. need
groceries,
they need restaurants, they need all those kinds of things. And the same thing with NMSU. I mean, NMSU is a major economic driver of Las Cruces and
absolutely.
A major employer.
Well, and the other thing we haven't even talked about is NMSU has always prided itself on being an international university and having students from all over the world come here to learn. And
the graduate enrollments are down. And
the travel
restrictions.
Especially
among the international students, and that's huge for NMSU.
Right.
International students have been key in a lot of the important big departments.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, international students are just afraid to travel, and understandably so. I just think this is a difficult time for the university, obviously.
It is. And the university also said, Dr. Ferme talked about in one of his emails about that he sends out an international student who's studying at NMSU was stopped by border patrol or
ICE.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. And I haven't enough coffee today. And was stopped by ICE and kind of harassed a little bit and allowed to go back to their place. But, you know, nothing came out of it. But still.
It's scary.
It's scary. And, you know, what a difficult situation to be in. You're here legally and lawfully and then you have to.
And many of these international students come for longer periods of time for, say, doctoral work, and their families come along. And mm-hmm. I'd be very skittish about bringing a family into this environment, too.
Right.
So it's really that's going to have a negative impact because these students are not on lottery money. I mean, this is new money. This is really good money coming from these foreign governments.
Right. And
or for the students themselves.
Right. And, you know, so how do we ultimately benefit from that? These students are just going to wind up studying somewhere else.
That's right.
And they'll bring their smarts and their research skills somewhere else.
Well,
and that's what we're seeing with researchers, too. Or if they're doing important work, they'll get wooed away by another university.
Right, yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
These are challenging times, but that's why we need journalism, and that's why we are so glad that you come in and speak with us every month and fill us in on what you've got going on there at the Bulletin. So thank you so much, Susan Morey.
Always a delight to have you, Susan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.